This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, ideally in this first hour, we will say a few things about Meyer and especially Bultmann, which you read for previous meetings, but we didn't discuss. We'll try to understand how, in the first hour, how scholars move from the canonical New Testament back to the Yeshua of history. And that'll be a number of steps in that. In the second hour, I will spend a certain amount of time discussing the Galilee of Yeshua's time, which does not fit our usual received notions of Judaism in Israel in the north of Palestine at that time. Okay, so today's class, October 17th, 2006, is devoted to peeling the onion. That's a bad metaphor because the idea of peeling an onion is that you get to nothing at the end. However, we'll find that there is substantial information about Yeshua of Nazareth to be obtained from the New Testament sources when they are examined historically critically. There are two problems at the very beginning as we now approach Yeshua, not just the background of Yeshua. The two problems are that the traditional confusion of the medium and the message. The medium of the preaching of Yeshua as presented in the New Testament is generally apocalyptic. It is generally mythological, because apocalypse is a mythological view of the universe. And that has plenty of problems today when we don't share the mythological view of apocalypse, unless one is a member of conservative evangelical fundamentalist churches, which do believe in an imminent end of the world. Roman Catholicism, my own tradition, has given up on the apocalyptic scenario while maintaining the mythologies about Jesus as historical, literally true. In most cases, certainly to judge by pulpit preaching, that's the case. Fundamentalists, however, have not. However, if we identify Yeshua's message with the apocalyptic packaging, we've made a major decision, a good or a bad decision. My purpose is to get to the message independent of the medium. That's difficult to do, the baby and the bathwater, as we sometimes refer to it. The second problem is to confuse the message with the messenger. That is to say, that Yeshua of Nazareth preached himself as the kingdom of God in person. In that phrase, kingdom of God in person, I'm citing the third century Christian theologian Origen. Surely, those who followed after Yeshua made that tight identification of the message of Yeshua with the messenger. But I will try to argue that that's not the case. We don't have access to the psychology of Yeshua. We don't know what he was thinking. We have his words and his deeds, and from that can deduce more or less what he was thinking. And what we find out is that he was entirely exocentric. He was focused not upon himself, but upon this thing that he called the kingdom of God, which was a different way of leading one's life. And it has nothing to do with whether he was good at leading that life, whether he was a perfectly sinless person. And I think I will argue that it's misplaced to ask, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus think? As if Jesus were the point. Jesus, Yeshua, is dead. You may believe that he is alive with God. That's an act of faith. Historically, all we know is that he died on April 7th of the year 30 CE. That's the best date that we have. And that he was never seen again. In fact, if you read the first canonical gospel by Mark, it has two endings, one written by Mark and one written by a scribe who tried to update Mark. The ending of St. Mark's gospel, or Mark's gospel, says that once Yeshua died, even though people believed that he was at the right hand of the Father, he was never seen again by anyone. So, the messenger and the message. I feel that so much of Christian spirituality today is about cozying up to Yeshua, loving him and being so sure that he loves you. That's a great tradition in Christian spirituality, but it has no basis historically in his intention. I suspect he wouldn't like most of us. We'd be too bourgeois, certainly I would. And he was quite, not exactly Mr. Nice Guy, when it came to issues like family values, which we'd like to attribute to Yeshua. Once his mother and family came to visit him, basically to pull him back home and drive and pound some sense into his head, and he refused to see them. He said, "This is my family. These are my brothers and sisters and mother." Well, that doesn't sound like family values. And when he says, you know, if you think that you have to bury your dead, then you've already lost it. Let the dead bury their dead. Come follow me. And other such things. It's not clear to me that he was Mr. Nice Guy. I'd like to make a distinction again that I've made with you before between the historiography and historical events. Historical events, they're way back then. They are recorded and interpreted in the next level up, historiography, allowing you today in the 21st century to decide whether those historical events, as recorded in historiography, let us say about Emperor Augustus, are historic for you. Historic means have impact, those events have impact on you. For some, that impact will be in terms of faith and liturgy and Christian adherence. For some, it'll be a cultural impact. You cannot read Milton without knowing something about Yeshua, etc. But our job is to bracket for a moment the historic impact of Yeshua on your personal life or mine. Then to take the historiography that we have about Yeshua, mostly in the form of the Gospels, and to see if we can't peel it back to get to the actual historical words and deeds of the Yeshua of history. We do that by means of the historical critical method, and we'll be doing that this evening. The word critical often sounds like negative carping, criticizing, and it doesn't mean that at all. The Greek word krisis, which is the origin of the word critical, or the verb krinein, which is the origin, mean to simply make a reasonable judgment about something, not necessarily to make a negative judgment. And when you add the adjective historical criticism, rather, what we mean is that the science that we are using to bolster our judgments in this class, not in church, is historical science, secular history. So we get to the historical words and deeds of Yeshua of Nazareth through historical critical method. And in all history, the gold standard is high probability. Not mathematical exactitude, not the exactitude of, let us say, the natural physical sciences, but high probability. That's the best we have on Augustus, the emperor. It's the best we have on Julius Caesar, and it's the best we have on Yeshua of Nazareth. Again, with some introductory remarks, our initial task is to bracket the received stories about Yeshua. That's very hard to do. First of all, because you may have a religious commitment, and therefore the received stories have historic impact for you. And secondly, because even if you don't have a religious relationship to the Yeshua story, even our secular culture speaks of him as the Christ, as if everybody in television land believed that he was the Messiah. So we've got a received tradition about him. The History Channel is the worst offender. They're forever telling you, as if it were history, about Mary Magdalene, the three magi, and all of that sort of stuff. And the second reason why it's difficult is, of course, we may have our own personal relationship with this material. In any case, be forewarned that we will not get to the psychology of Yeshua. We don't have his therapist's printouted report. We will only get to the words and deeds that he did in high probability, hardly all of them, but those that we can be fairly sure that he said and that he did. We'll find out that most of the miracles that are attributed to him in the canonical scriptures have no basis in history. And it's not the village atheist who says this. It's one of the most conservative Catholic scholars today, John Meyer, whose article you read. When I say conservative, I mean within the consensus, he is definitely on the conservative side, who says that very few, none of the nature miracles attributed to Yeshua have any basis in history. Nature miracles means, we make a distinction between miracles where he changes nature, calms a storm, makes bread and fish be multiplied, makes a fig tree wither. Those are nature miracles, as contrasted with person-to-person miracles, healing the sick, raising the dead, perhaps, and curing the blind, and so on. So, we set about our task of trying to distinguish the message from the medium. And in order to do that, we have to know the how as well as the what. So we're going to try to go through the steps of the scientific method whereby we arrive at the message of Yeshua. First, a few remarks about John Meyer and Rudolf Bultmann, the two brief texts that you read. According to Meyer, the best we have about Yeshua is that he was a charismatic preacher of wisdom. Not a preacher of the end of the world, but a preacher of wisdom. And that wisdom is built into his unique way of speaking, which was not to give catechism lessons or theology lectures, but aphorisms, let the dead bury their dead, or parables, which are like Zen koans, which say nothing about God, but tell you a story and leave you with a dramatic decision to be made on your part. Now, it's true that he makes these, he does this wisdom preaching in the context of what he thinks is a decisive, important decision that he wants you to make, a decision to completely turn your life around. The Greek word for that is metanoia, a complete change of mind, not just your mind up here, but the way you act, towards a radical ethics of justice and compassion, mercy. Secondly, he's a wonder worker of sorts. Now again, reputation will exceed performance, but because there are very few of the miracles that are really have any historical basis in his actual deeds. And third, he is a teacher who has repercussions on Torah observance. He was not there to found a new religion. He had no intention of being a Christian, which sometimes makes one wonder why Christians insist on being a Christian if Yeshua had no such intention. In any case, that got him into some sort of conflict with the religious establishment, but mostly with the Roman establishment, when he was foolish enough to go to Jerusalem in the year 30 CE at Passover time and was executed as a messianic pretender. Now, Bultmann. Bultmann begins with the first texts about Yeshua in the 50s, St. Paul. And what he finds is that Yeshua has already been reinserted into an apocalyptic tradition of end of the world with his imminent return. Yeshua has been raised or awakened from the dead, which is an apocalyptic trope, not an historical event, but a faith interpretation of the meaning of his death. And the apocalyptic framework of imminent end of the world is where one finds Yeshua, Bultmann says, and that's problematic. Let me, if I may, show a few slides that I think I'm behind on here. First of all, I'm trying to make the distinction between Christ and Yeshua. Christ with his $65 hairdo and that lovely beard, and Yeshua, this face constructed by a forensic anthropologist in England based on Semitic skulls of Semitic males of the first century CE. So while this is not at all a picture of Yeshua of Nazareth, it's a depiction of what a male of that time would look like. And he didn't have a lot of time for haircuts. The point is that Yeshua plus faith interpretation makes him the Mashiach, the Christos, the anointed one of God. And the Christ of St. Paul and the Gospels, minus the faith interpretation, gives us Yeshua. That's a simple formula. And it's much more complex than that, but at least we're in the ballpark with this. On the Christ side of the equation, Yeshua is the Christ, an affirmation made by only some people who believe that he is the Christ, are most of the fundamental issues that define traditional Christianity. In 1915 and following, a group of conservative evangelical scholars published a group of pamphlets, later gathered into a couple volumes, called The Fundamentals, which is the origin of our word fundamentalism. And they listed a series of the fundamental issues, they thought, of Christianity. If you believe them, you are a believing Christian. If not, you are not. Virgin birth, his messianic status as Lord and even as divine. The nature miracles, calming storms, multiplying food. His death, That's certainly an historical event. That could be over on the Yeshua side. But interpreted as blood atonement for the sins of humankind, expiation for sin. His physical resurrection, a coming back to life in a glorious new body that can be touched, that can be seen, that can talk, etc. Of course, with that physical resurrection go the appearances. Mark mentions none. The more appearances occur as you get later into the Gospels, until by the time of John's Gospel in the last decade of the first century, Jesus actually cooks breakfast post-resurrection for his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. The commissioning of Christianity, in effect the beginning of a new religion, right, at the end of Matthew's Gospel, for example, as depicted on the facade of the Memorial Church here at Stanford. So Jesus was indeed separating from his Judaism and moving in the direction of a new sect, according to this vision. His physical ascension into heaven, reported in only one evangelist who can't decide what day it took place. And finally, most dramatic for evangelicals, his visible return at the end, which is only the beginning of the end because there's going to be a 1,000-year kingdom, prior to which the Jews will be given one last chance to accept Yeshua as their Messiah. Probably they won't, and we won't even talk about the consequences of that. And then the kingdom of 1,000 years, which however will be disrupted by Satan at the end, and Yeshua will have to destroy Satan one more time. Not just at Armageddon, but at post 1,000 years, Armageddon plus 1,000. Then he will create a new heaven and a new earth. That's all on the Christ side. But on the Yeshua side, we have a set of questions. This is where we're located. First of all, what was his message? Secondly, how did he preach it? Third, what was the outcome? And lastly, who was he? What was his message? Again, I'm stating these things dogmatically by way of an overview, a table of contents, of you, if you will. All scholars, believers and non-believers, who investigate the teachings of Yeshua, and there are many non-Christian believers. There are Jewish observant Jews, there are non-observant Jews, there are atheists, there are agnostics. It's quite a rainbow spectrum of interpreters. All agree that Yeshua's message was not himself. He did not, to use the traditional language, come down from heaven to thump his own chest, but rather came to speak of God's power coming on earth. His code word for that was the rule of God, the reign of God, R-E-I-G-N, reign of God, the dominion of God, or as it's commonly known, the kingdom of God. Matthew's gospel changes the word God to heaven because out of respect for the deity, he goes unnamed, so it's called the kingdom of heaven on earth, however. That's all about the power of God. Not the power of God as if God were going to appear and thump his chest, but power in the sense of empowerment of human beings. Let's face it, God's doing very well, thank you. He doesn't need your attention, your prayers, your worship. It's we, you, us, Yeshua would have said, who are in deep need of God's presence and power. So let's change that word power to empowerment. It's God empowering human beings, not talking about the end of the world, the crash and burn scenario of apocalypse. We'll have to spell that out in greater detail. That empowerment, of course, is contingent upon metanoia, the changing around of your whole lifestyle to a radical ethics of justice and mercy, as we'll see. How did he preach it? Not by lectures, not by catechism lessons, not dogmatically, but by parables, certainly not by apocalypse, right? By parables, by aphorisms, and by living it out in a dramatic new way. In the Middle East, meals matter. Who gets invited, who is not invited. The hierarchy of table placement is very important. We're more or less used to, too often, I'm afraid, eating on the run, eating by oneself. And hierarchy at the table may not much matter. Mom or dad can sit anywhere they want, not in the Levant. Yeshua, however, by breaking the hierarchy of table fellowship and inviting the uninvitable, imagine having your place next to Yeshua, and on your right is a lady of the night who has not stopped her work, perhaps. That's Yeshua eating with the unclean, the impure. Yeshua eating with tax collectors, very hated group of people, but seeing that they too can be in need of compassion. This table fellowship of equals is already modeling what he thinks God's empowerment of human beings would be. One of the texts that we're sure that he announced is often called the Beatitudes. It appears most noticeably in the beginning of Matthew's Gospel. Who is blessed? Who is anointed? It's the outcast. It's the poor. And poor were not usually the object of compassion. They were usually, it was often thought that if you had a problem like that, if you had illness, if your child was born deformed, it was a punishment from God. Blessed are you, the outcast. Yours is the kingdom. And in the famous parable at the end of Matthew's Gospel, not announced by Yeshua, but expressing the attitude of Matthew's community, those who say, Lord, Lord, we went to synagogue, we were there all the time, never get in to the kingdom. It's those who, without even knowing that they were doing it for God or for Yeshua, helped the outcast, the imprisoned, the naked, etc., and who are quite surprised to find out that they are admitted, in Yeshua's view, to the reign, the dominion of God. So, that table fellowship is an important, visible living out of the message. And thirdly, he does it by reinterpreting Jewish law, not abolishing Torah observance. But there were many debates about how to observe Torah. There were two different warring schools, or at least debating schools, the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai, Hillel being more lenient, Shammai being more orthodox, if you will. Yeshua was certainly on the Hillel side, plus in terms of Torah observance. The Torah is made for human beings, not the reverse, he says. The outcome is conflict. The outcome is actually failure. While he has an initial following, an enthusiastic following among some people of Galilee, sooner or later they fall away. And you find in Yeshua a condemnation of various cities for not following his teachings. Perhaps in a last-ditch effort to revive his movement, he takes it to the heart of Judaism at the wrong time of year. He takes it to the temple state of Jerusalem at Passover, when the city is probably multiplied by six times its normal occupation, and when Roman soldiers are there to see if there's any outbreak that was often connected with religious observance, and the Passover feast celebrating the liberation of the Israelites, according to the book of Exodus. And there he is nailed as a messianic pretender, and that is to say, someone who purports to be a new king of the Jews, which the Romans don't tolerate, and they torture him to death. Who was he, positively and negatively? Again, we're bracketing the received tradition that would say he proclaimed himself as the Messiah, the Son of God, the Anointed of God, and according to John's Gospel, even as the equal of God. Negatively, we'll find out that there is no basis at all for such claims within the historical Yeshua. There certainly is a basis within the communities who follow, that they believed that of him. So in any case, there's a major distinction that we've been talking about in these two slides between Yeshua and the Christ. Let's review, if we may, the context of many Jewish observers of the time, not of all, not of the Sadducees, for example, not of all Pharisees, and perhaps not even of Yeshua. And it was indeed the apocalyptic view of the world. Apocalyptic is the worldview of oppressed peoples who, having found that they are powerless in the face of empire, you have to recognize, when those empires came through, Alexander's empire, it eviscerated the temple state model of the Levant in the Near East. A temple state, of course, is one where you have a king over here, and a priest over here, and it is a theocracy. They reconfirm one another. Ritual practice at a temple, whether it's Jewish or whether it's Babylonian, is a way of supporting the divine right of the kingly ruler. The kingly ruler is involved in religion, etc. Alexander abolishes that, in effect, and the Seleucids after him. And it is a crisis that I can only compare to the invasion of the Mayan and Aztec lands by Cortez, which destroys not just a life and, you know, a society, but a world vision, everything that held you together and made sense out of this cosmos has been defeated. Apocalypse is the literature of the defeated, and as we say, it especially comes forth in the 2nd century BCE, when in the 170s, Antiochus II, God in person, as he called himself, Epiphanes, God appearing in front of you, after attempting to Hellenize Jerusalem and having some success, violates, blasphemes against the temple state by putting a statue of a Greek god that looks remarkably like Epiphanes himself just outside the temple on the altar of the Holocaust, probably not inside, in the Holy of Holies. And that abomination of desolation, as it was called, gave rise to a revolution led by the Maccabee family. Apocalypse, however, is the opposite of revolution. It's not taking up the gun or the sword, but waiting for God to take up his sword and break in from the outside and defeat the Gentile oppressors and institute a messianic rule. Often in apocalyptic literature, there are many texts, you have the announcement of a messianic kingdom without a Messiah. It's all of the people who are anointed as God's blessed ones, without distinguishing out one king, one military political leader. So this diagram that you're looking at here depicts the old age of sin, not just personal sin, but the whole world seems to be ruled by a dark force represented by the Babylonians or the Persians or the Greeks, right? It's Gentile rule, which God will end and initiate a new messianic rule. I like to think of it as, I have up here five A's at the top of this slide, five letter A's, but I should have put six because I just revised it recently. So this is an acronym, a way of, not an acronym so much as a way of remembering some of the attributes of apocalyptic literature and the apocalyptic worldview. The first A stands for the absence of God. Since 586 BCE, the destruction of Jerusalem and whatever temple was there, God seems to have been absent, just as the God of the Aztecs and Mayans disappears when the God of the Spaniards, the conquistadores, comes in and defeats their temple state. That's an essential part, that God seems to have been absent, but faithful Jews, the Anoim, the few leftover remnant faithful, hold that he is going to come back with a vengeance. The second A of the apocalyptic worldview is the appearance of God. And that's the literal meaning of apocalypse. It means God pulls back the veil and appears, reveals himself anew. So revelation doesn't refer to words in a book. In this view, it refers to the inbreak of the vengeful God. He will at that point end the age of defeat and repression and initiate the age of anointing or blessing, the messianic age. At which point, and Daniel 12:3 is the first time it's mentioned, the dead will be awakened. The word resurrection is never used. And it's not used in the New Testament either. I mean, not only that the English word resurrection isn't used, but even a Greek word corresponding to it isn't used. Instead, metaphoric terms, awakening or standing up after falling down, are the terms that the New Testament, the Christian scriptures, use, as does Daniel. It is the awakening of the dead. And after they are awakened, they will be anointed. That is to say, visibly made God's blessed so that they shine like the stars in the heavens. Right? And we who are still alive at that inbreak, we won't be awakened, but we too will enter the messianic kingdom and be the among the anointed. And the last point, the last A, after absence, appearance, age of blessing, the awakening and the anointing, is the trope of apocalyptic literature, which is prophetic prediction, so that you can anticipate that inbreak of God by watching the signs be ticked off, right? Often by predictions of events that have already taken place in order to give you hope that soon the last predicted event, the inbreak of God, will happen. So much for context, looking back over what we've covered. Sorry that it takes so long. It's important now, as we try to peel back the scriptures, that we find out when they were written, when they appear. So the slide that you're looking at now presents the first century CE, first century of the Common Era. And Yeshua's life, the life that we know about Yeshua, spans at most 2.5 years, perhaps less, 18 months, his so-called public life, that is to say, between his baptism by John in the Jordan and his execution by the Romans in the spring of 30. Between Yeshua and the first written text of the New Testament, or the Christian scriptures, a 20-year blackout period occurs. That is to say, we have no literature, but lots is going on. So it's by interpreting the literature that comes out of that blackout period that we begin to make sense of what happened, what sorts of reevaluations of Yeshua took place. Paul's epistles, which arguably are not Christian in our sense. Yes, he believes that Yeshua is the Mashiach, but he doesn't mean to found a new religion. He certainly doesn't think that there are bishops or, you know, priests with special powers, or that we should set up churches that are going to go on for thousands of years. Paul remains a Jew, but he's on a mission to spread the messianic, Jewish messianic message even to the Goyim, even to the Gentiles. He feels that that's the real mystery that has been revealed in these latter days, which is that God will not simply save the people of Torah observance, but going back to Abraham, to the pre-circumcised Abraham, let us say, therefore, the pre-Jewish Abraham, who is promised that he will be the father of nations, right? Paul thinks, this Jewish charismatic preacher thinks, that God is now fulfilling that promise and taking the blessings that was reserved for the Jews during the Israelites during this preliminary period and making it available to all. It's a radical new message. But it's still a Jewish message. It's a messianic message. Another blackout period from the last epistle of Paul, the epistle to the Romans. There are a lot of other epistles written in his name, Ephesians, Colossians, 2 Thessalonians, etc. But they're written really by people who write in his spirit, so they think, and therefore assign his name to their texts. The next text is Mark, and there's a radical change. Paul knows nothing about Yeshua, his historical life. He doesn't know who his brother is. He probably does know who his brother is because his brother had become famous in Jerusalem. He doesn't know about any miracles that Yeshua performed. He never mentions one parable that Yeshua preached. Paul is and delights to be ignorant of Yeshua, because for him it all happened after Yeshua died. That's when God came into action and began the apocalyptic moment, not visibly, invisibly, but trust me, says Paul, soon it will be visible. We are at the edge of the appearance of God. By the time, however, you get to Mark, Matthew, and Luke, let's leave John aside for just a moment, that is to say, between the years 70 and 85, all of a sudden you have sayings of Yeshua, narrative stories of Yeshua, framed chronologically by his baptism and his death. Or as you get to Matthew, his birth, Matthew and Luke, his birth and his death. And by the time you get to Matthew and Luke, they extend it into 40 days or some period after his death of miraculous appearances. In other words, Paul simply gives you headline statements. We call them kerygma, announcements. A kerux is a messenger who announces something, the way town criers used to walk through the streets and announce, you know, Twin Towers attacked by planes. But they don't give you the full story. Paul is a kerygma preacher or a kerygmatic preacher. He doesn't give you stories about the resurrection. He just says Yeshua was awakened. Headlines, if you will, telegraphic in style. When you come to Mark and then Matthew and Luke, you get narrations, stories, things that capture your attention, that have plots to them. Good guys, bad guys, struggles, fights, miracles, finally culminating in his execution. You see the difference? And by the time you get to John, you get a different type of gospel. It is a gospel of sermons, of long discourses, no longer aphorisms, no longer parables, but rather of discourses of Yeshua about himself, because by the time you're at John's Gospel, by the end of the first century, Yeshua is proclaiming himself divine. Before Abraham even existed, I am, he says, quoting Exodus 3:3 or 3:13, I'm not sure, the name of Yahweh in the Hebrew Scriptures. So anyway, this gives you a sense of the layout of the texts. But it's not that simple, really. As we'll see, there's something that goes into these sorts of texts. Let me read, there's a question in back, please.
I don't know if you mentioned the Q text.
I'm coming to that now. I just wanted to lay out the canonical, what you'd get if you opened a New Testament. You'd get epistles of Paul, actually they come second, right, then the four Gospels, but Q and Thomas are quite important. So this slide here gives you some sense of when Yeshua lived, between 27 and 30. Imagine Canaan, or Palestine as was called at the time, divided into Galilee in the north, Samaria in the middle, and Judea in the south. The word Jew, Jewish, applies to Judea mostly. Samaritans are those who stayed in, or some of those, who stayed in the land of Palestine when the exile took off the most educated, well-to-do Jews to Babylon. They intermarried with non-Jewish people so that when the Jews returned and rebuilt the temple, they refused to let the Samaritans have a hand in building, rebuilding the temple. So there's enmity between the southern part of this territory owned by the Persians and the middle part. But then there's this upper part, Galilee, which is even further away from Judea. The followers of Yeshua originally are from the Galilee. Galilee comes from a Hebrew word, Galil, which means district, and Hagoyim, the district of the Gentiles, the district of the non-Jews, because there was a lot of Hellenistic influence in there. Galilee, the land of the Gentiles, the Goyim. It's there in the Galilee that the original followers of Yeshua begin to circulate sayings of Yeshua, aphorisms, some parables. Their focus is on the life of Yeshua. They never even mention his death, resurrection, or any apocalyptic material until later it creeps into Q. Whereas the community of his followers in the south around Jerusalem, from which comes Paul and others, focus on his death and his awakening. It's two different theologies, two different communities. Now, they all get blended together into the Christian scriptures of the New Testament. But what we're trying to do is peel back and find different textual sources and different communities who are underlying those textual sources. Q represents, first, the oral tradition, presumably up until about 50, because it takes some 20 years for that tradition, 30 years for that tradition to finally get written down. And then it must be written down in Greek, because as we'll see, two evangelists cite it verbatim. They must be citing the same text. They cite it in Greek, and if there were an Aramaic text underlying it, they no doubt would have different translations. So presumably, sometime around 50 CE, these oral traditions start to get written down. They get written down in layers, as we'll see. Q1, we distinguish out, which is probably 7 or 8 pages of text. Basic affirmations on the part of the original followers after Yeshua's death. Q2, a second layer, in which, perhaps because they encounter resistance to their fairly radical lifestyle, certainly purity laws, no divorce, no sexuality with other people, but also radical poverty, radical sharing. Somebody wants your coat? Give me your shirt. You know, that is not exactly what your mother tells you when you go out to school, you know. Oh, give me your pants, too. And that's almost the way it would sound in those days. So this kind of free lifestyle, freed up by Yeshua, we'll find out why in Galilee, then becomes at a second level judgmental. They're angry at those who criticize them, who go against them. Perhaps there is where encounters with Jewish authorities or social authorities. So that's where you get condemnations of people and apocalyptic predictions that they're going to get theirs. And finally, in a third level, you get the additions of interesting materials such as the temptation by Satan after his baptism, and prior to that, the baptism itself, and so on and so forth. In any case, without going into detail now, because we'll be doing this for some time, oral and then written. At the same time, from around 50 to 60, you get the first texts, the letters that Paul wrote to communities of Jews and Christians that he had founded in southern Turkey and in Greece. There's a question, please.
What evidence do we have other than that our derivation from our imaginations of what we have as to what you said, of the fact that the people in Galilee were thinking about the life of Jesus and those in Judea were thinking about his teachings?
What the question is, how do we know that distinction between the northern community of Q and the southern community of the, with its emphasis on death and resurrection? Part of it is by argument from silence. The Q that we derive, and I'll show you in a moment by a chart how we derive that Q, doesn't mention the death and resurrection, doesn't mention the reappearance or any of the appearance or any of the apocalyptic language. Whereas the message that comes out of Jerusalem, which we know through Paul, which influences Antioch, and then he comes out of Damascus and then Antioch. In other words, you've got rural and urban, if you will, and the urban are the travelers outside of the country to Damascus, Antioch, and Paul eventually to Rome, are the ones who put the emphasis on the apocalyptic death and resurrection. So it's the argument from silence. Why doesn't Q mention this if it was a big deal for them? We must presume that most of those who were the originators of this Q community never went to Jerusalem. They didn't follow Yeshua down there. They heard about his death, but what was more important to them was the teachings that he gave during his life. By the way, excuse me for forgetting to say why we call it Q, and of course you may know that. The proper abbreviation in English would be S, and it would mean source, the source of the sayings of Yeshua. But because the Germans were the first, 150 years ago, to derive Q by a process of peeling away Matthew and Luke, their word for source is Quelle, Q-U-E-L-L-E, pronounced with a kind of a V sound, Quelle. So it has traditionally been called Q for Quelle, but you could call it the sayings source or the sayings gospel, something of that nature. Likewise, at this time, there's another sayings gospel that is slowly coming into its own, which was discovered only in 1945. It's called the Gospel of Thomas. It went through a lot of redaction for the next 100 years, and finally ends up as a Gnostic text, mostly, closer to St. John's view of things than to the synoptics, but that it itself is nothing but a sayings, a concatenation of sayings with no narrative spine. There is no narrative of Yeshua doing this and the next day doing that in the saying source. Continuing with these slides, the real event of the first century CE, the one that made the news, was not the death of Yeshua. Those executions, unfortunately, were a dime a dozen, so to speak. It was not the burgeoning little groups of Jewish believers in Yeshua's Mashiach, etc. It is the destruction of the temple state of Jerusalem by Titus. His father Vespasian had originally been assigned to repress the Jewish revolt, which began in 66 CE and ended with Masada in 73 CE. But Vespasian was called back to Rome to become emperor. And so he appointed his son Titus, or his stepson, I'm not sure, Titus, to take the 10th Legion and other legions down to Jerusalem. And they fought their way from the north to the south and eventually to Masada. And the destruction of the temple is the real dividing line and has great impact, of course, on Christianity. By this time, by 70 CE, most of the original witnesses, whoever they were, of Yeshua's life are long dead. And even second-order witnesses like Paul are dead. He died in Rome, no doubt executed by the Romans there. Peter is dead. James is dead. At that point, Yeshua has not yet returned. There's a burst of apocalyptic expectation that the destruction of the temple could well be one of the signs of the end. And since they've already inserted Yeshua into an apocalyptic framework, Mark, in chapter 13 of his gospel, as you know, as we've talked about before, makes that part of the apocalyptic anticipation, prediction. So the gospel period begins 40 years after Yeshua's death and ends about 60 to 70 years after his death. The Gospels, therefore, are very late, relatively speaking, very late documents in the first century vis-a-vis Yeshua. And as we'll see, they're highly interpreted documents. There's a question in back.
So just to clarify, probably nobody who actually ever saw Yeshua in person was involved in writing any of this down.
I think it's certain that no one... First of all, the question was... the statement was, probably none of the authors of those Gospels were eyewitnesses of Yeshua or of the events portrayed. The short answer is absolutely yes. That is the case, that they were not witnesses of that. They're recording instead the traditions held by communities which themselves may have gone back, their grandparents, their parents, etc. But the Gospels are not either eyewitness accounts. Again, notice that in the effort to stave off the shock of historical knowledge, traditional Christianity has tried to say that Mark got his story from Peter, that Mark may have even been present at the Garden of Gethsemane. There's a man who loses his clothes and runs off in his butt naked, as it were, and people have thought maybe that was Mark, so he was an eyewitness. Not so. There's no one today, as far as I know, outside of conservative evangelical circles who would hold that there were eyewitnesses. So Mark is the first gospel to be written during the Jewish revolt, right at the period of the destruction of the temple or soon thereafter. Matthew and Luke come in 85, and John, which we're putting aside for a moment because it's a radical departure from the other gospels, is written by the end of the century. So the gospels are late arrivals. How do we come to derive this hypothetical document, which virtually every scholar that I know of holds to, how do we derive it from the Gospels? There are three synoptic Gospels. Synoptic means having a common view. S-Y-N in Greek means together, common, and optic means view. Mark, Matthew, and Luke have a common view of the narration of Yeshua's life. The narration is set by Mark. He's the genius who sets out a chronology of Yeshua's life, inserts in that sayings of Yeshua that he himself has heard repeated. Matthew and Luke follow that narrative framework, and they too insert Mark's stories. But let's look now at Matthew and Luke, and I've tried to color code as best as I could the sources of both of those Gospels. Let's call Matthew, what color is that? Sort of orange up there? Let's call Luke green. So the box that squares out Matthew is all orange, and the box that squares out Luke is all green. First of all, the blue central swath of color in both Matthew and Mark indicates what they borrow, in Matthew and Luke, I beg your pardon, indicates what they borrowed from Mark. So they did have, each of them, a copy of Mark's gospel when they wrote their own. How do we know that? Because it's verbatim out of Mark. Maybe they'll change a word. Maybe it won't say said. It might be declared or cried. Or there'll be some little switch, perhaps, to fit their community's needs. But it's basically, if we can put it this way, copied from Mark. Now, it's not exactly copied. It's changed a little bit. But the order in which it's said, etc., is there. And you read that in the text that's up on the... posted on our website. So let's call that the blue that Mark and Luke share in common. So if I'd had time, I would have drawn an arrow from that blue to the blue of Mark, from that blue to the blue of Mark. Secondly, Matthew has material that is just his. It comes from his community, from his sources, expresses their needs, and often has Yeshua speaking to those needs. right? They put the words in Yeshua's mouth. And so that's called special to Matthew. Sometimes it's just simply referred to as special Matthew. And that's colored orange, the way the whole Gospel of Matthew is colored orange in our charts. There's a question.
Yeah, can you give examples as to issues?
Right now I can't because I don't have the text in front of me, but I'll find those and maybe I'll find them in the second hour and give you some examples of that. You'll see some of that, I think, in the materials that was up on the website, but I'll have to check that. Likewise, Luke has special examples, and there I can give you some examples. Luke's gospel, which some have declared to be one of the great pieces of writing and literature, is the gospel of compassion. It's often called that. Women have prominent roles in the gospel of Luke. The poor have prominent places in the gospel of Luke. That's why, here's an example of special Matthew and special Luke that just comes to me now. That while they both decide to give birth stories of Yeshua, Matthew has kings, the rich guys, the wise men, come and worship the child and bring gifts. Luke has the utterly poor shepherds, the outcast. And that's typical of his gospel. It's the outcast who is invited to this special moment of the birth of the Messiah. Another example in Luke's gospel is Lazarus and Dives. It's a story that he invents, and it's really quite beautiful. Dives in Latin and somewhat means rich man. So it's really a stand-in for the rich man and the poor man. Right? Dives mistreats Lazarus. Lazarus is covered with sores, and dogs lick his sores in this life. But when he dies, he goes to the bosom of Abraham. Dives, on the other hand, goes to the other place. And makes a plea from the afterlife. Couldn't you please talk to Lazarus and, you know, couldn't we have a little bit of water coming my way? Not a chance. Again, it's this reversal that tends to put the rich in a somewhat bad place, whereas Matthew doesn't have that feeling about the rich. Other things will be that Matthew, whose community is more rooted in its Jewish traditions than is Luke's, which is a more Gentile community, Matthew will often be more supportive of Torah observance than Luke is. These are examples, and I'm sorry that I don't have more at hand, but they give you a notion that they had independent sources, even if they're writing about the same thing, the birth of Yeshua, which is legendary to begin with, but their different tones come into those legends. After we do that, after we distinguish out what's owed to Mark, what's special to Matthew and Luke, there is this other swath of material that is common to Matthew and Luke. And I've colored it yellow in both cases there. And the deduction of scholarship for the last 150 years, it still remains an hypothesis, right, is that there had to be a common source that they were citing in Greek because they cite the same words. Maybe they'll change one word here, one word there. They cite them in the same order. So they must have had a text with sayings in order. That leads to the postulate of a text called source, the source of the yellow patches, if I can put it that way, in Matthew and Luke. So that's what we call Q for Kvela, or the sayings source. What we've done here is outline what took about 200 years, well, 150 years to establish. To put it roughly, it would be the 19th century up to the 1930s and 40s was the beginnings of the establishment of, you know, by the 30s, this was accepted as what we call source criticism of the New Testament, of the Christian scriptures. Again, criticism means reasoned judgment about the sources of the canonical gospels, the gospels that made it into the New Testament. But our question is, if we have a hypothetical Q, which all told comes to, in its first layer, about 7 pages, and in its third layer, including 1 and 2 and then adding 3, is about 20 pages long. Less, depends how big the print is, right? Is this the real Yeshua? It too is an interpretation of Yeshua, on the part of early communities, who in turn pass it on to other communities. Either they evangelize another village, or they pass it on to their children or to their in-laws. How can we find out how Q relates to the Yeshua who died in 30? Scholarship since World War II has made that move. Rudolf Bultmann, whom you read a week or so back, basically stops with Q. He investigates the various forms of sayings. Some of them are condemnatory sayings, some of them are prophetic, you know, in the sense of speaking God's truth to power, etc., etc. And he tried to find the social situation from which those sayings probably came. He, Debelius, and others, in effect, were talking about communities of Q, or us, you know, there wasn't a single community that gathered every Sunday to meet. There were various people in various villages who were not always in communication with each other, from which comes this tradition. Our question now is, how do we get from the saying source back to the source of those sayings? Yeshua himself. You see where we are in time. We're over the 8 o'clock, aren't we? Okay, let's take a break. This is a good place to stop. Let's take a few minutes off and come back and pick up where we left off. Gentlemen, we'll take up with the second half of our meeting. I had said that I hoped to finish in the first hour how we get from Q to Yeshua, and then take up in the second hour the status of Galilee at the time of Yeshua. But I'm afraid that we won't get to the Galilee tonight. We will get to it, and it perhaps pertains more directly to the to some future lectures. So what I thought I would do is mention how we get from Q back to Yeshua with a little bit of background material, if I may.
Before you check that,
yes, please, there's a question.
Did the Q document influence Mark as well?
No, there's no sign that Mark draws on Q.
All right.
He's probably writing elsewhere in the Mediterranean. He's obviously writing elsewhere in the Mediterranean than those groups that out of contact somewhat from the groups that give us Q. First, I'd like to say something about the sources that we use for getting back to Yeshua. So this, in a sense, precedes some of the material that we saw. There are really two sources, generally, and then we'll break them down. There are religious sources and secular sources, sacred and secular sources, if you will. The so-called sacred or religious sources are the Gospels, which are faith documents. But notice that there is a major distinction that more and more is coming into the fore between canonical and non-canonical Gospels. The word canon, with one N in the middle, means the rule whereby you rule things in and rule things out. The canonical Gospels are those four that were ruled in by the church later in the third century when it drew up its list of acceptable books, thereby excluding the list of unacceptable books and texts. Even within the canonical Gospels, there is this distinction between the synoptic Gospels, the common view of Yeshua Gospels, and the Gospel of John, which is based on various miracles that he did. That's how the gospel is structured, surrounded by discourses about basically himself. Whereas the canonical gospels are narrative, as is also John's gospel, narrative in structure with sayings stuck in. Those sayings, by the way, are usually called pericope. I'll write that on the board, P-E-R-I-C-O-P-E. The word peri in Greek means around, and kopi means to cut. A pericope is a saying or a story that you could cut out and place somewhere else if you wanted. They are independent stories, aphorisms, or miracles, and the scholars refer to them as cutouts, pericopes, if you will. One analogy would be beads on a string. You can rearrange them in another order if you wish, because they're independent. Mark usually unites them, and as you read the Gospel of Mark, you'll see this, by saying, and then. And then he said. It's, in a sense, literarily a fairly boring, basic framework. But these pericopes, these stories, narratives, etc., are cutouts. And that's why people like Bultmann and the so-called form critics were able to cut out each one and ask what was the context within which this may have arisen. We'll see that that has some relevance later on. So we have canonical gospels divided into John and the synoptics, and then non-canonical gospels, gospels that didn't make it in. For example, in the first century, there are the beginnings of the formation of the Gospel of Thomas, although it probably doesn't take its form until into the first 20 years of the second century, by about 120. Thomas's gospel has a more Gnostic, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, view of Yeshua. It's about inner knowledge, special knowledge that Yeshua communicates, as is John's gospel, about special knowledge brought to us by God from above, incarnate in Yeshua of Nazareth. However, in the fourth century, when the canon was being drawn up of the official acceptable books to the universal church around the Mediterranean, it was considered to be too Gnostic. And monks in Egypt, who had been using it for scores, if not hundreds, of years, had to hide their copies of, or throw away, if you will, their copies of the Gospel of Thomas. But because they respected them, they buried them nicely in the sand, and the sand preserved them. And that's why the Nag Hammadi find in the 1940s has yielded so many non-canonical gospels, gospels that were cut out, but which give us a view on how diverse were the opinions of Yeshua in the first two, three centuries before Nicaea makes its major attempt to shut them down. The second set of sources are secular. If those are sacred texts, if you will, written from within faith, the other are secular sources, and they can be divided into Jewish and Roman sources. The major Jewish source is the Jewish historian Josephus, who wrote around 90 CE. Josephus had been a member of the Jewish revolt against the Romans beginning in 66. He was a military leader, captured by the Romans, and eventually went over to their side and became their historian for the Romans, but a very sympathetic to the historian, very sympathetic to the Jewish cause. He adopted the name of the Roman emperor, the family of the Roman emperors of the time, the Flavian family, so he's called Flavius Josephus. And the text that in which he mentions Yeshua is called the Antiquities of the Jews, so the ancient history of the Jews, written about probably 90 to 100. He was probably born around 30 CE, around the time of the death of Yeshua. And in book 20 of those Antiquities, he mentions James, the brother of Yeshua, the so-called Messiah, Christos. You may know that that gave rise to a hoax. About a year and a half ago, was it? An ossuary was discovered. An ossuary is a box in which the bones of the deceased are put after the body is decayed. The bones are taken out, room is made in that tomb for another body, and the bones are kept in an ossuary. Ossa means bones in Latin, in the plural. I actually have seen the ossuary of the high priest Caiaphas. It's in the Jewish Museum in Jerusalem. Beautiful box, about smaller, certainly smaller than this podium that I'm lecturing from, maybe about 12 inches high and about 15 inches long and 8 inches wide. And it contains, empty now, but contained the bones of Caiaphas at one time. Well, based on that text in the Antiquities, somebody manufactured a false ossuary on which they wrote in Aramaic, enough to fool one of the best Aramaic scholars in the world, Joseph Fitzmyer, saying, this is basically the ossuary of James, the brother of Yeshua. So important was his brother that they put his name on the ossuary, not his father's name. Well, it turns out, of course, to have been a fake. While it was being shipped to New York to go on display, it cracked, and then eventually we found out who the fabricator was. You can read about it in the New Yorker if you go back and Google the articles. The second Jewish set of references to Yeshua are not helpful. They are rabbinical texts found in the Mishnah and the Talmud, which are basically late and polemic texts condemning Yeshua for being lawless and so on and so forth, but they represent later, not contemporary or near contemporary knowledge of Yeshua. So the second set of secular texts besides the Jewish are Roman texts, and there are three ancient Roman texts. They all stem from around the year 110 CE. Two of them are fairly good references to Yeshua or his followers. The other is somewhat dubious. Tacitus, who writes his annals about the year 110, mentions that he was, quote, put to death during the reign of Tiberius, Emperor Tiberius. That's between 14 and 38. By the procurator Pontius Pilate. Procurator was actually a misnomer. He was prefect, but later the rulers were called procurators, but he was actually prefect Pontius Pilate. That's a fairly definitive and the best secular historical reference to Yeshua. Pliny, who was a governor in Bithynia, in northern Turkey, right on the Black Sea, had some Christians in his town. So he wrote to the emperor asking for advice. What should I do with these people who, he says, sing a hymn on the first day of the week to Christ as to a god, small g, understood god, like one of our gods? And the emperor's rescript, his letter back, said, basically, if they don't do any harm, don't bother them. So that's the second reference. The third reference is a bit ambiguous, and it appears in Suetonius's Life of the Caesars under the life of Claudius. During the 40s in Rome, there was a conflict in the Jewish community. And it's not clear whether it was Crestus, he spells it C-R-E-S-T-U-S, Crestus, who was one of the leaders of the rival factions, or if the rivalry was over a man named Crestus. Now, that's a more dubious reference, perhaps to Christos, right, to the Greek word for Messiah, the Christ, but those are the best references we have. Nonetheless, I think that there's no doubt in the minds of the consensual scholars, that is to say the members of the consensus who hold the chairs and get the grants and do the work on this, that he was an historical figure. However, if you go to the back of the New Republic or the Nation, there's always somebody advertising a book that is called Jesus Never Existed. It's about $5. I've never bought it. And I have an Italian book, it's actually in the library, that proves that Gesù Cristo non è mai esistito, it says. Jesus Christ never existed. So there are lots of claims that way, just as there are claims that he had afterlives in other countries, but they don't seem to have any historical backing or following today. How do we get from Q to Yeshua? I mentioned that the gold standard in historical criticism, historical judgments, this is the history building in which we're meeting now, the gold standard for their approach to antiquity is high probability. And that's what we have to hold, that's the standard we abide by in trying to find out what Yeshua said or did. There's no question that in this reductive mood, this peeling away move that I'm describing as peeling the onion, that we're missing lots of what the actual historical Yeshua of Nazareth said and did. However, what we're trying to nail down is what we, in the 21st century, can affirm of him with very good probability. And even in the probabilities field, there's going to be a spectrum between very sure, very probable, to not so probable. That's why the famous Jesus seminar grades his words and deeds by color. Red means he almost certainly said that. This is real, original Yeshua. These are his words, logia, we say. Pink would mean that's very close to something that Yeshua would say, but we're not sure if he actually said that. Gray will mean it's fairly sure that that comes from the community, not from Yeshua. Black would mean it's very sure that that came from one of his following, his communities that followed him, rather than from his own mouth or a deed done by him. But whether you go by that color code or another kind of spectrum, high probability is the max, low probability, no probability would be the low end. There's a question.
Where would you see that spectrum?
Well, one place that you can find it is in the various publications of the Jesus Seminar. The Jesus Seminar takes a lot of hits in the public media, mostly because they have, this group of scholars, has decided to not keep their scholarship in the academy, but to reach out to churches, to reach out to communities, to put it out there in newspapers. Whereas this kind of scholarship, you can ask your own pastor if you don't believe me, this kind of scholarship mostly stays within the academy and never seems to leak out and touch a pulpit, right? However, the Jesus Seminar, founded by Robert Funk, one of the major leaders of the Biblical Society of America, just recently deceased, makes this effort to provide literacy to the layperson. And so they hold meetings in which these things are publicly discussed by groups of people. They go all around the country giving lectures, not just to one another, but to lay people. And they've come up with this, if you will, eye-catching color code that really represents what scholars do without color. I think Jones's article has really got it. I think Smith's article is off the charts. It just doesn't seem to make the grade, right? What Smith says about Jesus just doesn't seem to be historically right. And it takes so that the color coding is just a visual way of representing that. Secondly, they actually publicly voted on these issues. The scholars got together, some of them, including John Dominic Crossan, among them, right? And they voted, and they voted across that spectrum. Some vote black, some vote gray, pink, and red, and they represent that. They tell you what this group of scholars says. But because of that voting thing, I think they've been attacked. They're more attacked by the conservative evangelicals than are the John Myers and the now deceased Raymond Browns and so on, who hide away in the academy and only speak to graduate students. You know, so I think that's so one place that you would find that is in a very good text from which I took the slight readings that I gave you today. It's called The Complete Gospels. They don't color code there. They color coded in the words of Jesus. Is that the title of it, or the sayings of Jesus? There you get the red, pink, gray, and black. And then every once in a while they go back and revise that as new information comes out. So like all scholarship, it's an ongoing process. But that's the text where you could find it. And they put out a second volume called The Deeds of Jesus, in which they also color code the various miracles, etc. It's stories about his death, such things as the Jewish people saying, "His blood be upon us and upon our children," which has been used as the blood libel of anti-Semites, religious and non-religious, ever since, right? They are the Christ killers, right? That definitely comes out black. You know, it's not at all plausible. It's not, I mean, who was there to tape record it? Who caught it? All the disciples had fled, you know, and can you imagine the Jewish people doing that? You know, it's a result of a fight between Jews and Christians in the latter half of the first century that leads them to write back that. That's just an example. Let me give you five criteria that scholars use. These are the five main ones, and they're going to be subdivisions, for peeling back Q and getting to Yeshua. Again, minimally getting to Yeshua, only with high probability. The first two criteria, the first three criteria, form what I call the base. They are the basic criteria. And the next two form the superstructure. They are more corroborative criteria. First you get the base, and then you get to the superstructure. The first of the base criteria, I put it first, others would put another one first, is what we call in multiple attestation. That is to say, we now know from our last chart that there are various independent sources in the first century, literary sources about Yeshua. Let me list them. Q, which is independent of Mark, but it's not independent of Matthew and Luke. So if you found something in Q and in Matthew, that would be the same one source, right? Because Matthew is where we find Q. Q, Matthew, the Gospel of Thomas, right? Which is non-canonical, but paid important attention to by the scholars. The Gospel of John, which is a separate source. Even though it's very different, it often has more historical information about Jerusalem than do the Synoptic Gospels, because it's a gospel whose community was originally rooted in Jerusalem. So he knows the names of pools, he knows the names of houses, streets, people. It's a very interesting historical source, even though its theology is the most removed from history. It's the most theologized, divinization of Yeshua of all of the Gospels. The epistles of Paul are likewise an independent source. You will find, for example, a double attestation between Mark and Paul on the words that Yeshua used at the Last Supper when he instituted the Eucharist, to use the phrase. So, the more sources, independent sources, that you get naming things that Yeshua said or saying things that Yeshua did, the better chance, notice its probability, the better chance there is that this is has an historical base. For example, 1 Corinthians 7 plus Q plus Mark, three different sources, say no divorce. So that sounds like it comes from the mouth of Yeshua. Could well have come from the mouth of Yeshua. Multiple attestation in independent sources. The second source is called, the second criterion, rather, is called embarrassment. So I'll put up here for the first one, MA, multiple attestation from independent sources. The second one is embarrassment. Embarrassment vis-a-vis the later Christian movement or the later Yeshua movement. If there's something in the text that seems to be embarrassing to the community's understanding of Yeshua, it might mean that they couldn't have taken it out without people noticing. One prime example is the fact that he was baptized by John the Baptist. Now, it's the master who is greater than the disciple. No disciple is greater than the master. How are we going to account for the fact that Yeshua, as a young man, submitted himself to the baptism of John? That he actually learned from John? That he actually worked for John? Actually, the Gospel of John says that Yeshua was a disciple who actually worked. And his disciples worked with Yeshua for John the Baptist. That's an embarrassment to those who think that Yeshua is the man, not John the Baptist. John the Baptist should have been learning from Yeshua. Often, therefore, you get in the Gospels attempt to soften the embarrassment. Luke is the prime example. How are we going to soften the fact that Jesus was under John the Baptist? How about his mother and Yeshua's mother are cousins? How about they're both pregnant at the same time? And how about when Mary comes to visit Yeshua in the first chapters of Luke, the fetal John jumps for joy in his mother's womb at the presence of the Messiah, as it were, tipping his hat to the Messiah? Or how about John's gospel saying, I'm not the one you're looking for. After me comes one who's much more important than I. I'm not even worthy to untie his shoes, to loose his sandals. That's a way of softening the embarrassment. Or what if the apocalyptic church, we're talking now about the church writing the Gospels post 70, believing that Yeshua is going to return, believing that Yeshua had even predicted his return in Mark's Gospel and so on, what if you get in Mark's Gospel early on him saying, I don't know when the end's going to come, only God knows that. That's somewhat embarrassing. So the fact that it's there means that it was not the way they would then, you know, rewrite these texts, these facts rather, to show that Yeshua had more clout than John the Baptist. The third criteria, so after multiple attestation of independent sources, after embarrassing facts that can't be wiped out, for example, another one that occurs to me just now, is that Simon, who was one of the first disciples, who is the one who's called a pillar of the church, even by Paul, you know, he's a pillar of